for liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government program, brought to you in part by MetLife and Grantham University. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll discuss a new policy that will equip sub-federal correctional officers with pepper spray with AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel. We'll also learn more about AFGE's Young Program with VA Local 1988 Executive Vice President Geddes Scott. But first, we've been joined by Betsy Myers, author of Take the Lead, Motivate, Inspire, and Bring Out the Best in Yourself and Everyone Around You. Betsy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be with you this morning.
Betsy, you're also the founding director of Bentley University's Center for Women in Business and also have a number of years working in public life on the Obama campaign as well as in the Clinton administration. Tell us a little bit about what drove you to write this book, Take the Lead.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I guess what drove me to it was this. I've always had this fascination with leadership and always kind of, you know, even though I've been in these interesting places in government and politics and academia, it's always what's always kind of fascinated me was why people do what they do. You know, why was it that a Bob Rubin would walk down the halls of the Clinton White House and people would almost bow in respect? But he's also got the work done, where another cabinet secretary wouldn't elicit near the same reaction. And after I finished my 2 years working for President Barack Obama in his 2008 presidential campaign, I decided not to go into administration and really to step back and to step back into the leadership field. And I wasn't sure exactly how that was going to play out, but at the same time I got this book deal with Simon Schuster, Atria Books, which is inside Simon & Schuster. And we were, you know, they basically, Judith Kerr, the publisher, kind of said, well, you know, as we talked about this book, what, you know, Betsy, what do you think about leadership? When did it work? When didn't it work? So I set out, the book really is my journey of looking over, you know, 25 plus, almost 30 years of my career and saying, okay, when did it work? Where were people most motivated? When were they most productive? And at the same time, as I traveled around, I do a lot of work with corporate America now, they were dealing with this issue of engagement, lack of engagement, where 50 to 70% of American workers are disengaged in the workplace. So, you know, I was really stunned by that and also saying, well, wait a minute, but we spend so much money on leadership development programs, but we still, you know, have disengaged people and less than productive people in many places. So what are we teaching the right things? And my book really is kind of a compilation of stories and thoughts and places that I saw at work. And then sharing that, you know, became kind of a passion of mine, was sharing that with the world.
Many times when we think about leadership, we think of the person at the top. But you take a different approach to that and talk about how a leader can be anyone at any level. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's an interesting thing. I a lot of times as I go out and I speak to audiences, I always ask this question, which is how many in the audience think you're a leader? Raise your hand. And half the audience raises their hand. And I'm always stunned by that because I always say at the very least, you're leading your own life. You decide where to work. You decide how to show up, how to dress, how to present yourself, how to deal with conflict, how to communicate, how to clean up, you know, any relationships that are bad, have gone bad, or misunderstandings. You decide that. And I think it takes some of the victimness out of it that we sometimes feel in our lives, or it's easy to feel, which is, oh my God, I'm in this work for this federal agency. I don't like my boss, or I don't like these political appointees, or I don't like the career civil servants, or whatever it is that you're wrestling with. You know, it basically says, wait a minute, I've chosen to work here at the Department of Transportation. I've chosen this job. I'm here. And so what can I do to be my best? And if I don't want to be here, then that's a choice too. But don't leave before you leave, right? It's kind of like, okay, this isn't the best position for me or the best department or the best whatever it is. But then how do I take control of that and lead my own life?
When you find that people take control and lead their own life, what are the results that come of that in personal and professional experiences?
people are so much happier, right? I mean, you think about it. If you start your day and say, you know, today's going to really be a great day, and I'm going to go into the office, and no matter what I'm presented with, I am going to, you know, here are the 10 things that I'm going to get done today. And so you go in, you're more focused, and these are the 10 things I'm going to get done today that actually, because I have asked my boss or I am clear about what success looks like. And even when we're in places, well, what does success look like? You know, making that to say, hey, you know, I'm going to be here for 8 hours today, and I want to be the best I can be to move my department forward, to make a difference in my job, or maybe just to make somebody else's day around me better, instead of, you know, sitting on the internet all day, not doing your job, you know, looking at travel destinations, gossiping with friends about how awful things are. Which, what does that do? It sucks the energy out of us and our heart. And so what, you know, to start your day and say, okay, what am I going to do today to be my best self? And what are the things that I will do? What are the activities that I will do and concentrate on so that when I leave my job or I go to bed at the end of the day, I can say, you know what, today was a great day and I made progress. Not, you know, that I was mired in gossip and complaining and not getting stuff done, right? That's when we start to go, oh my God, that we go kind of, it's like, I always say it's like a downward spiral, right? Are you living a life of downward spiral of negativity, or are we living a life of upward spiral of positivity? And even in times when we feel like we don't have as much control, you can always control your attitude. You can always control the positive things you choose to do and not do.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Betsy Myers, the author of Take the Lead. Betsy, in your book, you break it down into 7 key points: authenticity, connection, respect, clarity, collaboration, learning, and courage. How did you come up with those 7 key points for the foundation of the book?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I put down all the stories, you know, because I had, you know, over 30 years in White House and a presidential campaign and Harvard and academia and business, and so put down all these stories. Here are the stories where I saw people being their most productive, or leadership working, or when I was most passionate, or when people around me were most passionate and productive. And then I took all the stories, and then I kind of said, well, what's the common thread that was going through these? And it was a great organizer of the material to say, oh, that's when people felt respected, or that's when people were being their most authentic self. And it was an easy way, kind of, it was a helpful way to kind of organize the material in a book where you have so many stories and what are you trying to say? You know, and for me, I mean, what I was trying to, my stake in the ground, like, you know, as I was writing this book, what's different about what I'm saying about my book? Because there's a lot of leadership books out there. And what I'm saying is that leadership creates a feeling. It's a different way to think about it. But if, I always say, people, if you close your eyes and you think about a time in your life when you were most productive, most excited to get out of the bed in the morning, you know, when you think about what was going on, who you worked with, who you worked for, where you were going every day, was it also not a time that you felt valued, felt appreciated, you know, felt listened to, understood, part of something bigger than yourself? So that's where, that was the premise of which I started. And then the 7 principles are a roadmap to help us get ourselves there and then the people around us.
In chapter 3, about respect, you told a really great story about a gentleman in an elevator with one of his employees. Can you share that with us?
Sure. Yeah, this story I love because Jerry Rossi is his name, and he's at TJ Maxx, one of the top people there. But at the time of this story, he was the CEO of Marshalls. And he and I heard him tell the story. It was my very first event when I was President Clinton's senior advisor on women in the White House. We had an event. President Clinton was very dedicated to eradicating domestic violence. And so we had an event at the White House of which Jerry spoke. And he touched my heart. And so 15 years later, when I'm writing the book, he, ironically, there is, you know, he's now TJ Maxx, and they're right here in a suburb of Boston. So I called him and said, can I come talk to you and can I tell your story? So basically, what he got in an elevator one morning, a snowy morning in Boston, and a woman got in the elevator with them who worked in Marshalls. He didn't know her, but she was hiding, kind of turning her body away from him, and she had big sunglasses on, which was a kind of, he thought, why does she have big sunglasses on in a cold, snowy day? So he said to her, well, will you come with me to my office? I'd like to talk to you. So she came, and he said, you know, you can take the sunglasses off. And she said, no, I don't want to. And he said, is there something you want to tell me? And then she did finally take her glasses off and shared with him that her husband was physically and emotionally abusive, and had, you know, been beating her up and their two kids. So that moment, Jerry was, you know, kind of educated about, wow, this whole issue of domestic violence. And he got very involved, helped her with, instead of turning it over to Human Resources Department, or, you know, or, you know, what a lot of people would have done is, well, that woman's acting strange in the elevator, but I'm late to a meeting. I mean, that's what's interesting about Jerry. He's like, wait a minute, what's going on with one of my people here, because I care about you. And long story short, he went on to helping her get away from her abuser. He, they helped her, the company helped her get a new apartment. They had security guards escorting her to and from her car every day for a couple years, and completely helped her transition into a new life. She's still now with, works for him, is now, you know, 15 plus years later, remarried. And but he's become completely passionate about this issue of eradicating domestic violence. It's one of the top issues that TJX deals with, you know, with his leadership. And he's also gotten involved on a national level as well.
Betsy, before we take a short break here, how important is it for maybe the individual here who you were describing, the young woman who was having problems at home, to have someone like the head of a major company reach out to her and say, listen, I care about you as a person?
That's what it's all about. You know, at the end of the day, what do we, what, in life, as human beings, we want to feel that we matter. You know, that's our basic human need, right? Is that we matter. Someone cares about me. I'm not just a number on a timesheet, that I'm actually a human being. And when, and that's the shift in leadership, is that when people feel valued, like she did, like, wow, he cares about me. I mean, she's still with the company, you know, 15 years later. It makes all the difference. And you get, you know, you can force anybody to do anything for a short period of time and command and control leadership, but you won't get their heart. And their heart is what Jerry was doing. He got her heart, but he also gets other, because of the way he leads, he gets the employees' hearts of those that work for him and with him, who then are passionate and excited and more productive. So all of this that we're talking about, leading with care and love, turns into successful companies, organizations, government projects, and that's what we're talking about. That's the big shift.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our discussion with Betsy Myers, author of Take the Lead.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. Joined by Betsy Myers, the author of Take the Lead, Motivate, Inspire, and Bring Out the Best in Yourself and Everyone Around You. Betsy, you have a number of phenomenal career experiences along the way, Harvard University, Bentley University, obviously working on the Obama campaign and in the Clinton administration. And your book is very uplifting and it's very positive. Talk about some times along the way where maybe you needed to heed your own advice and apply some of these lessons that you write about in your book to your own professional career.
Well, I, you know, I think we all, that one of the things that I think I'm pretty open about in my book is that we all, I don't care who you are, and sometimes it's easy, you look at someone and you say, oh, they've had all these successes, so they have no problems. The truth is that the higher you go up or the more experiences you have, the more times you skin your knees and you make mistakes. So I'm very open in my speaking and in my book about, whoa, let me tell you some of the mistakes, you know, that I made. I call it our sticky floor, that everybody, my friend Rebecca Shambaugh wrote a book called It's Not About the Glass Ceiling, It's About the Sticky Floor, meaning it's really for women, but men have it too, which is, what are the behaviors I'm doing that keep my feet stuck to the floor? So, you know, so I think sometimes one of the stories I tell in my book is that when I ran the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School, I came in and the woman who had been running the center before me stepped into a new role there as head of research. And we just didn't get along very well. We were incredibly different. She had very different ideas of where she had taken the center and not happy about where I was taking the center. And, you know, I found myself in a very difficult relationship that was getting in the way of my success and causing me a lot of grief. And so a lot of us find ourselves that in kind of difficult relationships inside our organizations or our companies. And what do we do about it, right? And so sometimes for me, my sticky floor is when something like that happens, I tend to want to ignore it, right, and just pretend it's not happening. But it got to the point where it was something I couldn't ignore. And so I went to her and said, you know, can we have breakfast and talk about how we've gotten to where we've gotten? And it's a very small research center here at Harvard. And how do we start over, right? And so we had this really great, painful conversation, but truthful about how we both were feeling. And I realized that, you know, part of what was going on was she's quite a bit older than me, had written at the time 7 books on leadership. I had not written one. And she felt that I wasn't respecting her history in the issue. And then I felt that she was, you know, kind of undermining me and not supporting my new leadership. So so much of it is human relations, the people feeling their feelings hurt, not feeling respected, not feeling valuable. And so we decided that day to start over. And one of the things we did, I always say that so much of leadership or, you know, getting the work done is by being able to clean up relationships and being able to build relationships and collaborate. So we committed to having lunch or breakfast every 2 weeks. And we did. And what happened was I started to go into her office and say, what do you think about this? Or how would you handle that? And she became incredibly supportive. But it was through building that personal relationship over coffee, you know, over eggs. And so that's, you know, that's for me, I think one of the big lessons is, you know, whatever, when you get to those places of tension, so much of it can be through, you know, willingness to have conversation and build relationship, even when you think it's impossible. There was a time when I thought there's no way I can ever have a relationship with her. And it just wasn't the case, you know, that we were able to do it. And even being so different, you know, and having coming from a place of difficulty, we were able to shift the dynamics.
And I think your point about the natural tendency maybe to ignore it or to just look the other way, when you went and confronted the issue and talked about it in a personal and professional way, you were able to make some headway on that.
Yes, because, you know, 90% of the time, if you go to someone and say, you know, gosh, I think we've gotten off, you know, we've gotten off a bit or off to a wrong start, or did I say something that maybe offended you? I always say, add I'm sorry to your vocabulary. It does amazing things. And so with almost anyone, not always, but I would say 90% of the time, you can clean it up with somebody. And, you know, nobody wants to have bad relationships in a work environment. And so most people are thrilled to say, you know, when you take the initiative to say, you know, gosh, I'd really like to have a better working relationship with you. And how can we begin to do that?
Betsy, another really profound personal story that you shared in the book was during your time in the Clinton administration when you were the first director of the White House Office for Women's Initiatives and Outreach. And a gentleman by the name of Rahm Emanuel, who you worked with closely during that time, gave you some interesting advice. And I'm wondering if you can detail that story for
us. Yes. I mean, you know, so one of the things I think I learned in my career was it's sometimes we have to think through, you know, how do people hear me? Are they hearing me? What's the point that I'm trying to make? Am I using the right language? Is this the right time? And so one of the stories I tell in the book is that in the White House, the chief of staff hosts a meeting. They do it in every White House in the first thing in the morning with the senior team and basically goes over the president's schedule. And then people go around their room to say, you know, what's kind of on their agenda or hot buttons or things going on they want the other people to know. And so I was running the Office for Women, and I think it was there maybe 4 or 5 months when Rahm Emanuel pulled me aside and said, you know, can I give you some feedback? And, you know, he basically said, Betsy, you know, we don't hear a word you say in the morning, which was just a stunner for me. You know, and he basically went on to explain that the way I was speaking in the mornings, I sounded more like I was one of the advocates, the women advocates pushing from the outside in instead of being on the president's senior staff. And so I sounded like I was just, you know, one of the women leaders. And he said, you know, you have to remember you are here, you know, working in the White House. You have to change the way you're presenting the material. So I was so grateful to him because I was able to do that. Because sometimes, you know, you have to step back and go, am I being heard? You know, what you know, is? Am I being as effective as I possibly can? And part of that is being willing to listen and even ask for feedback from our colleagues and friends who will tell us honestly, you know, when you say it like that, it ruffles feathers, or it's hard to hear, or, you know, I don't think we understood what you were saying, you know. But you have to, part of it is what I say in the book is so much of the leader in me is saying, what's my sticky floor? What's getting in my way? What are some of the things that I'm doing that might not be as effective as possible? We need to constantly do that in our life. You know, what are the things I can improve on? What are the things that I'm doing that maybe are keeping me from being as successful as possible?
Because the reality is, at the end of the day, you really never stay the same. You either get better or you get worse, right?
Well, you know what? I love the book, the title of the book that Marshall Goldsmith wrote, which is, what got you here won't get you there. So a lot of times people, on the abilities they have, it gets them to a certain place in their career. Then they plateau. And it's because they need new skills to go to the next level, or they are doing, they have behaviors that have gotten them to just that point. I mean, the things that are great about them, right? But then also the things that need improvement. So yeah, life is a process. I mean, I used to think, oh, you know, when I hit 30, I'll have it all figured out. Or when I hit 40, I'll have it all figured out, or 50. But the truth is that we're always learning and growing and changing. And what mattered to us at 30 changes when we're 50. You know, what maybe we're good at changes, or we have new awareness. So it's a constant growth if we're willing to step back and make the time for it in our life to say, wait a minute, what am I good at? What am I not good at? What are the things I need to improve on? How can I get the feedback so that I keep growing?
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Betsy Myers, author of Take the Lead. Betsy, on this notion of growth and continuing to improve and advance, all of your life experiences, personal and professional, have now led you to where you are today as the founding director of Bentley University's Center for Women in Business. Talk about the center, its mission, and how you're really helping to advance women in the workplace and leadership roles.
Well, Bentley University is this fantastic university here in Waltham, Massachusetts, which is about 15 minutes from Cambridge. And, you know, it's almost 100 years old, and I never knew that much about it. It's a business university. It's a private school. There's about 4,000 undergrads. But the kids, students who come here want to get their business degrees and are interested in finance, accounting, insurance, marketing. We have now the first woman president, Gloria Larson. And 5 years ago when she came here as a new president, she said, one of the things I want to do here as president is make a contribution to the world of women in leadership, because we have so many corporations here that recruit. All the top four accounting firms recruit out of Bentley. And why are we in, you know, this was in 2008-09 when she started to think about this. Why are we still, you know, at 10 to 15% of women in the top jobs in corporate America and on the boards? And how can we make a difference in this? Now, here's the thing that's exciting. One of the reasons I've been here a year now, I was willing to be the founding director here, is that the conversation has shifted, where what I'm seeing in corporate America is CEOs like Bob Moritz at Pricewaterhouse are saying, wait a minute, you don't have to convince me that we need to have more women in senior roles. I just don't know how to do it exactly. We've tried this program, or we've tried that leadership initiative, and it's gotten us to 15%, or it's gotten us to 20%. And wow, the workforce has changed. More women are entering the workforce every year. 60% of those graduating from universities and colleges and master's programs, women. And our customers, 85% of consumer buying is done by women. So wait a minute, the workforce is changing, our consumers are and customers are changing. We need to have a workforce that can relate to our customers, but yet we still are so heavily white male. And all of the research shows that, wow, companies that have more women in senior jobs and on their boards are more profitable. So our center is dedicated to being a repository of best practices of who is doing what and what is working to retain, support, and promote women across corporate America.
When you work with some of the people involved with the center, are you finding that once you help someone along and maybe advance her career, do you see just almost unlimited potential with people and women in leadership in that role?
Well, what we're doing now is we're going to be creating a program that really we have an executive program here that started for women. We just started this year working in collaboration with our executive programs, but we're also going to be creating a program which I want to take on some of the sticky floor issues that women. So there's so much the corporations can do, and then women ourselves have to say, well, what is my sticky floor? What are the behaviors I'm doing? My confidence, my language, my raising my hand, being more strategic, those kinds of things. So yes, I mean, I believe that if we are willing to step back and, you know, be more strategic, ask for what we want to, be conscious of the behaviors that might not be working for us, that the sky is the limit. At the same time, we have, you know, the world is changing and corporations are saying, wait, we want to create avenues and pathways for more women to succeed in corporate America and staying in the pipeline and not leaving.
Do you think that these lessons that you're teaching about how to succeed and become leaders in corporate America can also translate well to the public sector and federal agencies, state agencies, even in cabinet level positions?
Absolutely. It's all, you know, all these leadership skills I'm talking about in my book and in my work is all transferable skills. And, you know, the only difference is that, you know, when in government, there's not a bottom line. But, you know, I always say what is success, right? You know, leadership is about getting the work done. And what is the work that agency or that company or that academic institution is trying to get done? So that just what defines work might be a little different, but how people do that work or become more productive or happy in the workplace is all the same. Being, you know, for me, I've worked in government, academia, and business. The skills, you know, the leadership skills that have propelled me and the leadership skills where I haven't done as well, basically the same. It's our humanness. And whether we take that, our bodies, to one of these three sectors, it doesn't really matter. It's the same skills.
Lastly, Betsy, what is the best leadership lesson that you have learned throughout your career and who taught it to you?
Best leadership lesson.
Sorry, I put you on the spot
No. I think, you know what? So I think one of the best lessons I learned was from Erskine Bowles. And Erskine was my first boss in government. He was the head of the Small Business Administration. And then he went over to the White House and was the deputy chief of staff to President Clinton and then ultimately the chief of staff to President Clinton. And one of the things I learned two things from him. I learned a lot from him, but two things that stick out. One, he used to always say, understand what your strengths are, but more importantly, understand what your weaknesses are, and then surround yourself with the best people you can to counter your weaknesses. And that strong people are willing to say, this is what I'm weak in, and I need to find the best of the best. And the other lesson I learned from him is that I think sometimes what we do as women is we say, if I just work really hard, someone's going to notice. And we aren't as good as letting people know about what we're doing to support the goals of the agency or the, you know, department or the organization of which we work. And one of the things I watched Erskine do was every week our chief of staff at SBA would gather up all the things that he had done that week to support the president's agenda. And it was delivered strategically to the White House, to the President, First Lady, Vice President, Chiefs of Staff, to say, this is what I am doing to support what the President's goals are. And within about 16 months, he was taken from SBA to go over to the White House. And I think we have to remember that whatever we're doing, whatever job we're in, what are we doing every day to support the department we're in, our boss, the goals of which the agency, which I have decided, I'm a leader in me, that I have agreed to do in my job and then go about doing it and letting people know in varied ways that how they're supporting the initiatives of the organization. And those are the two things I learned from Erskine that have stayed with me.
A couple of great pieces of advice. Betsy Myers, the founding director of Bentley University's Center for Women in Business and the author of Take the Lead, Motivate, Inspire, and Bring Out the Best in Yourself and Everyone Around You. Betsy, thank you so much for your time and coming on here to join us
today.
Thank
you. It was really nice. Anytime.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel will explain a new pepper spray policy in the Bureau of Prisons.
I just earned my degree at Grantham University, and now I'm on my way to a promotion.
Grantham University?
The affordable online classes fit my schedule. Plus, I earn college credit for work experience.
How can I fast-track my degree at Grantham University?
Go to fasttrackedu.com.
Fasttrackedu.com?
Yes, fasttrackedu.com. If you're an AFGE member, you qualify for a tuition discount. Check out Grantham University today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Dale Desotel, AFGE's president of its Council of Prison Locals. Dale, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Jason. Good to be here.
Dale, we have some exciting news here for our listeners. Of course, a new policy in the Bureau of Prisons, a pilot program that's going to allow some correctional officers in the Bureau in about seven facilities to now carry pepper spray while on duty. Tell us about this policy.
Yes, we had some discussions with the agency. We've actually been in discussion with the agency since the murder of our officer, Jose Rivera, in 2008, trying to get more tools for our officers to protect themselves in these, especially these high security facilities. And it began, I guess, with Representative Cardoza, who drafted the first bill to get the pepper spray to our officers, especially in these penitentiaries, as an added tool for them to protect themselves. Because, as you know, our correctional officers have a body alarm attached to the or in working as their radio that they the only means of assistance that they have outside of another officer, which that has been reduced through budget cuts and what have you. So we're excited about this pilot program that we're going to introduce this oleorosin capsicum aerosol spray pilot program, which is a 3 to 4 ounce canister of pepper spray to as the last resort to try to diffuse a situation or protect the officer from bodily harm. In other words, if an inmate has made a decision to attack or to assault an officer, that person with the pepper spray, if they have the opportunity, can certainly draw on that tool and that means of a protection, as well as the radio calling for assistance in the situation. So hopefully we can reduce the number of assaults and also save someone's life. And it also can be used to save the life of another inmate, you know, or to stop the assault of another inmate. So we have that. We have had the spray at our disposal prior to this, but that was always going to be used during a situation that was pretty much out of control. And it's available, but it's only under the use of the direction of the lieutenant or the captain after something has already happened. This, however, gives it to the officer themselves, and they will be able to use it at last chance or last defense for an assault or what have you to defuse a life-threatening situation. So we're very excited about it. It's a pilot program, but it will run for a year. And it starts shortly in August, so hopefully we have some feedback by October, the next time we meet in our partnership forum, to see if we've had to use it or if it's been effective. And hopefully it will be effective so that we can expand into our other institutions and even to other staff members within the institutions that are named.
Dale, speaking of that, what are those institutions? And within those institutions, are there particular parts of the facility that the pepper spray will be allotted?
Yes. All of these institutions are penitentiaries. United States Penitentiary Coleman in Florida, there's two of them there. One and two. So those two facilities will have it. United States Penitentiary in Florida. Florence, Colorado. United States Penitentiary in Lee County, Virginia. United States Penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. That is actually one of our SMU units, special management units. That is a very volatile place. United States Penitentiary, Pollock, Louisiana. United States Penitentiary, Atwater, California. That is where we had the incident where we lost Jose Rivera. Inside those facilities, we have what we call the special housing units. And so the pilot program will allow these aerosol dispensers to certain people, including the operations and our activities and special housing lieutenants. So the three lieutenants that are usually on duty at any given time will have it. Our compound officers, who usually run the compound, the movement of inmates from food service or to hospital or to any kind of programs from to and from their housing units. Our housing unit officers within those facilities, the movement officers that move the inmates from one place to another or monitor the corridors, and our SHU, what we call special housing unit officer, two of those officers in the special housing unit will have it as well. And any other post that deems reasonable or necessary during the pilot can be added or can be changed, according to our agreement with the regional director's approval. So it's not. This is what we're going to begin with. This is what we're going to start with. I don't know if we're going to change it or add anything to it. I hope we add a few to it because we do know that sometimes in the food service area where they eat, it's crowded at certain times, and sometimes there's issues there. But that's all to be added later. Hopefully, we can get some good feedback on this program with these people in these particular institutions in these particular areas, and see how good it can work for us, and then expand then after that.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Dale Desotel, president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, as you know, obviously, the Bureau of Prisons sees a number of assaults on inmates in facilities across the country. But the seven that you mentioned here that are going to be part of the pilot project are seven of the more violent and volatile facilities that are in the Bureau. This change in policy, what will that mean for worker safety, the facility safety, and ultimately the surrounding community's safety?
You make an excellent point. That would it would greatly enhance all of it, our officers' safety. Perhaps even send a message to the inmates that we're not going to tolerate assaults, even amongst themselves. We're going to do everything we can to stop bodily harm, which would automatically increase the safety of our staff and our officers, and naturally increase the area surrounding these facilities as well. So, yes, it's going to be a great change. This has not happened in the history of the Bureau of Prisons. They've been very hesitant to agree to this because, in the past we've been able to talk to the inmates. In the past we've been able to deal with them, but society has dealt us some, these guys are more violent. They're overcrowded. They're frustrated. The atmosphere inside these places have changed because of the nature of the inmate themselves. It's not anything that's that can be fixed in the spur of the moment, but with the staff cuts, we've reduced the number of staff that we have. We've got overcrowding in these places. So, talking to an inmate still is a good way to do it. However, with the reduction of staff and increasing inmates, it's getting increasingly impossible to be able to deal with issues that inmates have. And they get frustrated amongst themselves. And so I'm just thrilled that we have finally noticed that there is a need, and let's at least address it, at least try it. And, and that way we can say, we're going to do everything we can to enhance the security and the safety of our staff and the inmates and the community. Exactly.
Dale, as we close out here, does this renew your sense of optimism going forward in dealing with the agency and trying to enhance the safety of the facilities and put these protections in place for the workers?
Yes, as I said, this has never been done. This is a move that We have, as the union and AFGE, has pushed for and looked at, and you know, along with our stab-proof vest, you know, what else can we do? You know, what else can we do to enhance the safety? The money shortage on and the staffing levels has decreased, so this is a positive step in trying something, doing something, you know, not just sitting back and saying there's nothing we can do and looking for better ways and looking for other alternatives. And even if it's a last-ditch effort, and even if it's a something that we hope we never have to use, it's there. It's there. And our training is what we have stressed we need to know, because in any situation, any law enforcement officer has to be able to react, not think. They have to be able to react, and training is the only thing that can give us that. They have to be able to react. Do I need, is this a life-threatening situation? Do I need the pepper spray? Will it contain it? Will it diffuse it? Or do I have time to get assistance and try to talk, you know, and use the conventional methods? This is the importance of our training, so that we can react and not have to think. And that's what we stressed when we met with the agency, and they understand it totally, because they don't want to abuse it and have it abused or have it misused as well. So hopefully we can do a good job on our training and move it forward to where that all the staff would have available to them in every institution, and the inmates too will get the message that, listen, you know, we have issues, you have issues. The officers didn't sentence you. The officer has a job to maintain security, and we need you to comply with our rules and regulations and our programs for your own safety as well. So that's the message we ultimately want to get back into those prisons.
Dale Desotel, president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, thank you for your time today, and congratulations on achieving this step in worker safety.
My pleasure, and it was a work on a lot of people's part. The AFGE, the local presidents, our legislative issues, our legislative friends on both sides of the house that help with law enforcement issues. It's a great effort from everyone.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE VA Local 1988 Executive Vice President Geddes Scott will discuss the union's young program.
I just earned my degree at Grantham University, and now I'm on my way to a promotion.
Grantham University?
The affordable online classes fit my schedule. Plus, I earn college credit for work experience.
How can I fast-track my degree at Grantham University?
Go to fasttrackedu.com.
Fasttrackedu.com?
Yes, fasttrackedu.com. If you're an AFGE member, you qualify for a tuition discount. Check out Grantham University today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Geddes Scott, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's VA Local 1988. Geddes, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I first want to get your sense for the development and progress thus far of AFGE's Young Program, which is tailored towards AFGE activists under the age of 40 and, of course, seasoned mentors as well to help them along. Tell us about the program and some of the activities that you've had so far with it.
Well, presently, AFGE Young is geared towards the newer employees that have come in the door, the ones who really didn't grow up within the union the way that I did. It's there to foster them, encourage them to take ownership of the organization. We are aging as an organization, and Young is meant to kind of mentor these younger ones coming in the door so that they understand better what the union is, the fight that's left for them.
How important is it for AFGE and the labor movement really in general to have opportunities like these for younger people to come along and get acclimated to the union and pick up where the older, more seasoned activists are leaving off?
Well, like anything in life, it's a cycle, and we have to educate, incorporate new ideas, new individuals, new energy into an already established one. The union as it is right now, it's great, it's growing, but we also have to realize that it can improve, and for it to improve, we have to kind of bring in these younger individuals who can take on these leadership roles, come with new ideas, new energies in ways that others can't. Not saying that we don't have the ability But the organization, we do have to, as much as we appreciate the seasoned, we have to appreciate the youth.
I think it's important to note, of course, without the leadership of the more seasoned mentors and some of our older colleagues who are in the workforce, we wouldn't be able to impress upon the younger generation the importance of these things. But the reality is that some of the older workers will be retiring. Baby boomers are getting to that stage where retirement is coming for them. It's important to be able to have people who can pick up the torch and continue the traditions that the labor movement has, correct?
Correct. We sometimes forget that, you know, we have to, at one time or another, we're going to have to pass it on. And I was lucky to have somebody look at me as a young man and say, Geddes, I want to bring you along. I want you to see these things. And took the time to invest in me, to invest in my VA or and union career so that I would understand. So when they're ready to walk out, I would be able to carry on their fight, carry on the union fight, the good fight. And that's what we need with the young people. We need to get them in early so that they understand, they have a buy-in to what this is all about. Because when we do decide to leave, you don't want to leave it and they have to start from scratch. They don't have an idea.
Or not have anyone to turn it over to.
Correct.
Now, you said how important it was to you that someone invested in you. Talk a little bit about that and what it really means to invest in a person and the impact that can have on his or her life.
Initially, when people say union, when they said it to me as a young man, they, oh, get us the union, it didn't register. You know, you heard about it, you watched about it on television, but you had no idea. And they took the time to take me to a VA convention. And I didn't know anything that was going on. And it was one of the most enlightening experiences I could ever have. Because at that point now, when they said a union, when they said a union meeting, when they said bills on the floor, and they said Congress and the effect of these things, it registered because you understood what your organization was. It wasn't just my building. It wasn't just my unit within the VA. It was something broader than that. I understood that the government, AFGE, wasn't just about nurses. It was about those that handled food. It was those that did our border patrols. It was our police officers, our firefighters, our army soldiers. It became something bigger for me, and it made better sense. And I could then go to other young people and say, no, you need to be at the meeting because this is what it's about.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Geddes Scott, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's VA Local 1988. Geddes, what are some new ideas that you think you could bring to the table? What things do you think could be improved upon?
Well, as an organization, we have to acknowledge our mistakes, and in acknowledging our mistakes, move forward. We have gotten in the habit of, I don't want to say endorsing, but we need to start to encourage our own candidates. We need to start to grow our leadership, not just in the union, but also in the political arena. We have so many talented individuals all around the country that at some point or another, we have to start to say we're pushing our own candidates. We have to take the fight back to those individuals that are bringing the fight to us. They demoralize the government employee in so many ways, but the government has, we as a union need to address it in a commercial. The same way they address their issues in a commercial, we can do the same. The same way they commercialize the need for the privatization and these commercials, we have to show them the need for the federal employee and where the federal employee is.
Do you see social media as a resource that could help in that regard?
Definitely so, because as young people, we don't spend as much tube time as the generations before. There's more Twitter. There's more Facebook. There is more immediate responses. So instead of saying, okay, I'm going to shoot you an email or I'm going to send you a letter, you'd rather tweet someone of what's going on or Facebook post of what's going on within the organization. And they're more encouraged with that.
Within the federal service, you, of course, work for the Department of Veterans Affairs, a critical agency in this country, and that agency is in the midst of a possible downgrading of positions. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and maybe the response that AFGE has to these position downgrades within the agency?
Well, ultimately, what's going on now is VA Central Office, for whatever reason, is attacking our lower wage earners, which is unacceptable. We understand that we're all expected, and in my own home, we're expected to do more with less. But the VA, for some strange reason, they're attacking those that make less. The senior executive staff are not taking cuts. And what's happening is that if it happens in one VA, it happens in all. OPM has this fashion that if you downgrade a food service worker from a $25,000 salary to a $20,000 in Texas, they have to now apply that across the country. It's not just in Texas. It happens across the country. So the VA at this point, we just had a rally. where we went in front of VA Central's office and we let them know, listen, that's not acceptable. We understand we all have to do more with less, but cut from the top. If you're saying, you know, if your senior executive staff's going to take a $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 cut, we'll all understand. But they're not taking a cut. And you can't look at somebody who makes $25,000 and say, well, cutting their salary is now a benefit.
When you bring these issues up to the agency, what kind of response do you get?
Well, basically, it's always, it's not me. It's somebody else. It's Congress. Well, you understand the financial constraints. And that's why when I was on the Hill, when we were in D.C., and I went up and I spoke to my representatives in New York, and they all said the same thing. You know, we side with you, Mr. Scott. We understand. We support VA. We support the vets. I asked them, honestly, I understand what you're saying, but I need you to now go across the aisle and speak to your other friends, because as much as you say you support me in New York, if it happens in another state, like predominantly right now it's happening in Texas. So if it happens in Texas, it's going to happen in New York. So you need to, being that you see this Texas representative or senator, you need to go speak to him personally and let him know. Call him out in front of everybody else. If you say you support vets, then what are you talking about? If you say you support the VA and the initiative that we are going to take care of those who took care of us, then what are you talking about downsizing and cutting these employees' jobs?
Explain the impact of cutting the wages of a person who makes $25,000 or $30,000 a year, employees within the VA, many of whom are veterans themselves.
Well, ultimately, the positions that they're attacking are the positions that vets will get as soon as they come into the VA. It's normally your EMS, your cleaners, people that clean the facility, custodial, your secretaries, the frontline people. Those are the positions that they're more apt to get coming in from deployment. They're not the highest, but it gives them an opportunity. It's healthy. It's therapeutic because it gets them the opportunity to give back to the government, give back to the vets, because they're still in the system. Now, to take those employees who've now come back from serving, they're making between $25,000 and $35,000, and tell them after serving your country and you're getting this, it's a low-paying salary. I mean, you can barely live on that. And cutting that even further. Now, how are they going to provide for their families? I mean, in these economic times, we understand what it is. But these guys already gave the ultimate sacrifice. And then to come back now and then cut their salaries even more, it's disgraceful.
Ultimately, what would you like to see in this situation? What outcome is acceptable?
Acceptable right now is address the finances where their finances need to be addressed. We take care of the vets. The frontline individuals are the ones that actually hands-on touch these vets. The senior executive staff, you touch paper. If we're going to say what the VA is about patients, not paper. And if you need to cut, then cut where you can. You can't take away from the bedside nurse. You can't take away from the person that's answering the telephone or keeping the facility clean for those vets that gave the ultimate sacrifice. I think in all actuality, we've forgotten, or the VA has forgotten, what they were actually put in place to do.
Geddes, what brought you to public service?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you. As a young man, I got a job at the VA at 20, I think it was around 23, 24, and I fell in love with the vets. It was the weirdest thing in the world. They weren't like any other client in the world. They had character. They had stories. And from then, it was, yeah, I could have gone anywhere else and made more money, but I felt good at the end of the day because I did something for somebody who really did something for me. When you see these guys who don't have any families, don't have limbs, and you become their family. And that's what I think drew me in and kept me there.
That element of serving, of being a part of something greater than yourself, of that personal connection, do you find those similar attributes in your involvement in the labor movement as well?
Definitely, definitely. Because you find yourself doing for those who either have done for you or can't do for themselves. And it's, even if you believe that you're tired today and you don't have the energy for some strange reason, that clock goes off and you have the energy. The bell rings and you're ready to go out there and give them what you got.
Ultimately, as we work towards the end of 2012, what are you looking forward to the most?
This year, honestly, there are two things. One, we were working on this VA with the downgrading. I think it's a very serious issue because, again, it affects Americans. Once they start to do things within the government and they start to affect people's ability to provide for their families, I think that in and of itself as a society, we can't allow that to happen. The other thing is the upcoming election. I believe, honestly, we dropped the ball a couple of years ago, and we're more aware now than we ever been that we have to support those who support us, and we have to get people out there. They're attacking us in so many different ways now that we can't just take a year off. We have to keep the fight up.
Geddes Scott, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's VA Local 1988. Geddes, thank you for your time tonight. Look forward to having you on again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to our guests this week.
Take the Lead author Betsy Myers, AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel, and VA Local 1988 Executive Vice President Geddes Scott. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government.